Show.
Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Middle of the week already. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, where you can find the Listen Live button, the PayPal button, the Contribute tab. Yes, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. And, of course, The Horn is also available on a wide variety of streaming platforms, such as the TuneIn app for smartphones, be they iPhones or Android devices, as well as the Stitcher radio app. There are a number of platforms out there for getting The Horn, though. Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku devices, if you've got one of those, we're listed there. Goodness gracious, you can get the podcast at iTunes. You can also get the podcast address directly at WhiteRoseSociety.org under the Head On With Bob Kincaid subdomain. Long week, Marty? Marty says, what's with this already stuff? I've felt nearly every second of this week. Well, yeah, there's an aspect of it, of that, too, but somehow they just, daggum, they seem, the weeks seem to get faster and faster and faster. Time, indeed, is relative. You'll notice when your relatives are visiting, it slows down considerably. To the point of approaching stasis, even. Now, it's the middle of the week. It's prayer meeting Wednesday. I'll acknowledge that. But here in a few minutes, I'm gonna hold off on the whole prayer meeting shtick. Because here in a few minutes, I'm hoping the phone will ring and that it will be my good friend Mike Wiggins Jr. from he's the tribal chairman of the Bad River Band of the Chippewa or Ojibwe Indian tribe of northern Wisconsin. He has been a very, very, very busy man. I watched via the Indian Country TV live stream feed earlier today as the Bad River Band went to the capital, the state capital at Madison, and gathered and talked about why it is that the Pinoki Hills and the whole region there that the Pinoki Hills drain into, which is largely the tribal lands, ceded treaty territories of the Bad River Band. And if you want to follow more closely, my advice would be to like a group on Facebook. And I'm looking for it here. People concerned about the Pinoki Hills. I'm pretty sure that's pretty close, but here, let me get the exact name of it. Won't take long. Oh, goodness me. It's a little further down in my notifications than I thought it was. Well, anyway, a gentle reminder that we still have Sal's $50 challenge on the table, and we are $30 away from meeting that. That was from last night when someone steps up and does something like that. It's awfully nice when we can respond, because it's a good way of doubling one's money. You know, we try to raise about $150 a night. And here we are, the day before the end of February, and we are about, $280, I think. $280 from meeting this month's fundraising goal. Well, daggum, I want to make sure that I give you the right name on this. Oh, there it is. Sorry, I'm a little slow that way sometimes. Citizens concerned about the proposed Pinoki mine, P-E-N-O-K-E-E, Pinoki mine. Is an open group you can follow on Facebook. You can also follow Mike Wiggins Jr. himself and keep up with that struggle. And it's a bit frustrating because this struggle needs national support. Because frankly, it's easier to protect something that is thus far untouched, unencumbered, than it ever is to stop them once they get started. Here in Appalachia, we're struggling to save what little we have left. The struggle in northern Wisconsin is vastly different because they are trying with all their might to save something that has not yet been destroyed. It is, as I've noted before, a magnificent and beautiful place. I keep finding myself showing up in these areas where, you know, non-religious me finds myself saying, well, no, I don't do that whole get gussied up on Sunday and go to church and catch a nap while the preacher screams thing. But if there is something, if there is a sense of the sacred to be had, it is much more easily reached out in what in that language is referred to as creation. I had that sense among the giant redwoods of the Pacific Coast. And I also had that sense in northern Wisconsin, at the source of the Bad River, a little natural lake called Lake Caroline, out of which flows a tiny stream that becomes the Bad River and flows to Lake Superior and fosters and creates these beautiful wetlands, magnificent ecosystems, and has supported human life for longer than most of us can even really contemplate human life being around. I mean, we're talking 10,000 years, maybe 15. As I said, when I first got back from my first trip to northern Wisconsin, just looking around, even though it was December and getting cold, it was my one thing, and that is that everything was there that humanity needs, not just to survive, but to thrive. Fish in abundance. Grain in the form of wild rice. Open ground flat enough for some rudimentary gardening. Resource game for hide. Oh, my God. Because, see, we cheat. We cheat when we think that human life is only life worth living if it's the life that we are content with. If we manage to stay alive as a species, people will look back at us in a few hundred years and think that, and they will not be able to imagine living with the privations with which we dealt. What do you mean? What do you mean, Dad? They couldn't just go around the corner to the transport pod and go halfway around the world. Were they barbarians, Ma? Then there's the other side of that coin. They will look back at us, blowing up everything under the sun. And be pretty convinced that, yes, we were barbarians. That's why, for those of us, people like us in the Horn family, who aren't necessarily into gouging the planet for every last bit of relentless, remorseless profit we can drag out of it, those of us who are into the idea of there still being humans on this planet 100, 500, 1,000 years from now, that's why we stand up. Because if nothing else, while no individual among us may merit so much as a paragraph in history, the attitudes that we strike certainly will. For we are arrayed against people who would destroy this planet down to the last living thing in order to what? Money? Can't eat money. But in places like northern Wisconsin, people have lived and people can live for thousands of years. And that is the very essence of sustainability. It's about 12 minutes past the hour. Let's go to the phones. I suspect this is my good friend, Mick Wiggins, Jr., of the Bad River Band of the Chippewa Ojibwe people. Mike, is that you?
Yes, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you? You've had a very long day.
Yeah, it's been a very long day in Madison, Wisconsin, watching the state legislature get ready to vote on their mining bill.
I watched some of the live stream broadcast from Indian Country TV today, Mike. What is the present status of that vote?
All indications are that the mining bill is going to pass today on a vote of 17-16. They're just debating some Democratic amendments to what is essentially a Republican-sponsored bill. And those are systematically being shot down as they move towards the vote for the legislative hit piece that the mining company essentially wrote.
Well, I've told the Horn family a little bit, Mike, about what's going on up there and about the mining bill. When you talk about these amendments, what kind of things are the Democrats offering? Are they trying to ameliorate what's already a bad bill? If some of it got through, would it still be a bad bill?
Well, there's kind of a double whammy that is contained in the flawed legislative bill that the mining company wrote. One is, from a permitting standpoint, the permit process is essentially just riddled with holes and made super porous, so that when mining companies apply to get into the earth, essentially it's garbage in, garbage out on a permitting side. Timelines have been shortened. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has had its teeth gutted in many instances in terms of what they can ask for as far as, thorough documents and mining plans. On the permitting side of things, it's been a very shortened, made to be a very service kind of process, so that essentially a mining application would just sail right through.
Well, just and by way of background, Wisconsin at one point in time, up until now as a matter of fact, has had one of the most profoundly protective environmental laws in the Union. Is that correct?
Yeah, Wisconsin has a very logical, very rational law on the books. Number one is kind of a prove-it-first type of law, where if you want to mine in Wisconsin under current mining law, the likes of which is about to be changed today, you need to show that your mine has no, you know, human health impacts that are going to be catastrophic, that your mine is essentially safe to humans and relatively safe to the ecosystems and waterways around the project. That's being discarded. In addition to that, Wisconsin mining law has a ban on sulfide mining, you know, which involves the use of hundreds of thousands of gallons of sulfuric acid. The first part, the prove it first law, and in that body of law, logical, legislative bullet points that empower citizens and put the onus of responsibility on the mining company are all being discarded. And there's talk in the Madison Capitol that the ban on the sulfide moratorium, as they call it, the ban on sulfide mining is being discussed, and there's chatter about that, dismantling that.
God.
Current mining law is essentially the result of Wisconsin forefathers understanding that these extractive industry projects come with such a catastrophic and devastating effect that, you know, they put good, solid, logical laws in place through bipartisanship to ensure that Wisconsinites were protected, to ensure that Wisconsin lands and waters were approached with integrity, and all of that's under attack right now. So, you know, so when we look at the new bill, like I said, the permitting process has been eroded. But what's even more sinister is that there, through exemptions and through just straight language, the mining company can bypass essentially environmental protections. Anytime there's an instance where the new mining law comes into contact with environmental protections, the ABSB 1, the piece that they're looking at today, says mining law will trump and the environmental protections will step aside, essentially. What's interesting about that is it's kind of a clever little legal trick that allows the mining company to do an end around the environmental regulatory framework. So you have what are essentially mining company officials and Republicans in Wisconsin saying this does not weaken environmental protections. What they don't tell you, and what they've omit, is the fact that it may not touch environmental protections to a certain extent, but it doesn't matter anyway because the mining company does not have to adhere to them. So, but as Senator Dale Schultz, a very courageous Republican who has stood in the face of these types of efforts in the past, said in a press conference regarding this new mining law, you cannot go from not being able to fill in rivers, lakes, and streams and wetlands with waste rock to allowing a mining company to fill in rivers, lakes, and streams with waste rock and tell me that environmental protections have not been weakened. You know, there's just a lot of lack of common sense and you know.
Well, the nakedness of their greed is on full display, is it not?
It is, you know, and it, you could follow the money trail and see the mining interests just flooding, you know, some of the Republican legislature with money and you know, it's a really, really sad thing to see. And that's also evident in the overwhelming oppositional public testimony, no matter where they held hearings in the state of Wisconsin, even if it was 400 miles away from the areas where the mines are going to be. Wisconsinites turned out overwhelmingly to reject this mining initiative, but it's like there's been a deaf ear turned to Wisconsin citizens.
I think that goes without saying, and somehow or another, even though I don't know, it drives me crazy, Mike, that it's a West Virginia hillbilly, if you will, who's behind so much of this. Chris Klein is, you know, what is he? I think a 2009 article said he's worth $1.7 or $1.8 billion, and he dragged a lot of that out of the earth here, and he dragged some more of it out of the earth in southern Illinois. And now he's coming after y'all, and it makes I feel terrible. It's part of the reason I'm so honored to have been a part of all of this struggle, just as a chance to try to say, you know, we're not all like him. What sense do you get of the ore, as I understand it, that is in the Pinoki Hills, lies under sandstone, pyrite. There's going to be horrible environmental and human health consequences that flow from this. Are they just saying, trust us?
They are. The mining company has essentially sold a lot of the Republican legislators on that very notion. Trust us. They have very superficial schematics that they've flashed around, and some of the legislators have displayed that show crude, almost elementary school type mine designs that, you know, essentially showing the ore going down into the earth in a little wedge where our pit's going to be. It's so simplistic that one can only, you know, essentially gather that some of the folks are so enamored with the mining engineers that they'll believe anything they hear. In fact, there was one particular Republican senator who traveled up north and sat with a family from only a mile away from the epicenter of you know, this essentially open-pit mountaintop removal. And he told that family at their own kitchen table in the shadow of the Pinoki Mountains, trust the mining company. Trust the mining company. You know, we have a mining company president. The GTAC is Gogebic Taconite is the name of the mining company. The president, by a man by the name of Bill Williams, you know, once said, if we run into a problem, we'll ensure our way out of it. And he's essentially talking about the, you know, the mountaintop removal of a old mountain range that is over a billion years old and that has unbelievable pristine waterways and great aquifers running, you know, underneath it. It's the recharge station for the groundwater aquifers underneath our tribal homeland, you know. So if we run into an environmental problem, we'll engineer our way out of it. In another hearing, he was essentially saying, he wrapped up his testimony to some of the Republican legislators by saying, so in summary, in our reclamation, what you have is, you know, essentially the circle of life playing out, as though a mining company that's going to take the head off of a mountain range and destroy a watershed is somehow recreating the circle of life. It's just absurd, and there hasn't been any in-depth scientific analysis that has truly studied the human health or the ecological impacts of what's taking place, and that's all due to the fact that this is so egregious, and the legislation kind of really speaks for itself, that they need to fast track this stuff because the public continues to wake up, and it's getting the sleeping giant of the, you know, that is the Wisconsin citizenship seems to be awakening more and more each and every day. And Wisconsin polling shows 67% opposition, if I remember correctly. It was over 60% opposition to the mining bill, you know, in recent polls here in Wisconsin. So this is all fast track for a reason, because this is just, it's rather absurd when you really get into the detail and you follow the money and you look at it from a scientific standpoint. And if you look at it from an economic standpoint, I think West Virginia would know that the jobs ain't there, but the toxicity and the poisons definitely are.
Absolutely. And I understand that Ashland County and Iron County in Wisconsin have their economic difficulties, but this is no answer, Mike. We know historically here in West Virginia that the poorest county in this state has the most mountaintop removal. The most coal has come out of the poorest county. Poverty goes with this kind of extractive industry hand in hand. The citizenry does seem to be waking up, and one of the things that I think is waking them up, if my observations are correct, is that, you know, this isn't just a Pinocchio Hills bill. This is gonna open up the entire state of Wisconsin to blasting, is it not?
It sure is. It's mining law that is applicable wherever there's iron in the ground, and one of the places that there is in another county about mid-state of Wisconsin, Sauk County, the Baraboo Hills they call them, and there are lots of, you know, there's a large community there, and no one is mentioning that at all, and I would imagine it's because that hits more of mainstream Wisconsin. More of areas that
well-to-do
senators are from,
yeah.
Well-to-do folks, it wouldn't be very popular for folks to all of a sudden start realizing that the head's about to come off their hills, you know. So it's something that is applicable all over the place, and when you look at the mining law, a lot of the foundational underpinnings have to do with water, groundwater aquifers, the erosion of water rights, the elimination of paths of recourse if people are impacted by the drawdown of the water table, the ability of a mining company to put high capacity wells wherever they want. When you look at the notion of water and apply it to this bill, people all over Wisconsin wake up in a hurry as to what it really means, because we are a water-rich state, you know, especially up in the Northwoods, with some beautiful lakes, inland lakes, and of course, like our tribe does, and in the northern tip of Wisconsin, is that tails in with the greatest of the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, and its largest freshwater body, and it's a unbelievably powerful and sacred lake, you know, for all people, really.
Oh, I was the first time I set eyes on the region and on Lake Superior, Mike. I was dumbstruck. I'd never seen anything so beautiful in all my life. And I come from an area that used to be pretty doggone beautiful. But it's unconscionable and unimaginable to me. But these people seem hell bent on going forward. You mentioned high capacity wells. It is going to take it's going to take water to get all of this done, isn't it? I mean, they've got to process the iron ore. That's not a bunch of iron skillets under the ground.
No, it's going to, you know, it'll take tens of millions, if not more, tens of millions of gallons of water a day once they get going, and you know, the ability to draw down the water table. Coupled with the elimination of paths of recourse for citizens that are impacted. You know, we have homesteaders up in our neck of the woods there in northern Wisconsin that whose wells are driven down into the earth, you know, 150 feet, sometimes even shallower, you know, 80 feet. And this 1,200-foot deep, 4-mile-long open pit comes along. You can imagine the water table's headed out of who knows where. When those wells go dry, you know, I know folks in that area who paid upwards of $15,000 to $20,000 to get their wells put in the ground so that their house would have water. If their wells go dry, that's a negative environmental impact that's deemed to be necessary for the almighty dollar. You know, it's rather sickening. And
is that one of those things they'll engineer their way out of?
Yeah, we had a Republican legislator again. Say, oh, well, told that same family I mentioned earlier at the kitchen table, well, if we see your well starting to go dry, we'll just cock the mine there. We'll cock the groundwater aquifer. And that's been a huge joke up north in our neck of the woods and all that. That's where the jobs are going to come in when they build this, this gigantic, giant cocking gun. They're going to have to hire them to pull that trigger.
Yeah, it'll take that'll take at least 8,000 workers making $60,000 a year, won't it?
The
strange, surreal thing for me in watching this, Mike, is that it seems like not only has Chris Klein exported what he wants to do out of Appalachia, they've exported the talking points too. You know, I've been watching your page on Facebook. And I've been watching citizens concerned about the about mining in the Pinokies on Facebook, and I have seen it, every time I see one of the talking points come up that's being bruited about by the pro demolition forces in Wisconsin, I sit there kind of slack-jawed. And, wait a minute, I've heard this before. I saw one the other day where somebody said, "Well, you like to drive a car, don't you?"
Yeah,
I have stood at a rally underneath a sludge dam in southern West Virginia and had coal workers down here scream that in my ear. I kid you not. And the only thing I've found so far that they haven't used on y'all is, well, we need more flat land. Because it is kind of flat up there, except for the Pinokies. So I don't think you can expect to hear that particular talking point. But it's the same thing every time. Every time they want to go into an area of pristine beauty and a place that is supporting life, they use the same tired economic arguments that, you know, there will be Frisbees and wheat checks for everybody and money will fall from the sky. When they don't bother to tell you, for instance, I mean, I've been on those roads. Those roads are going to turn to gravel. As soon as the overloaded trucks start hauling out the ore. The water, as you mentioned, is going to get poisoned. And you know what? If you've got a drilled well that you spent $15,000, $20,000 drilling, you don't have a water bill. Now, there's thousands and thousands of people in southern West Virginia who had their own wells also, you know, that had supported their families literally for generations. The coal company came along, poisoned their wells, And the response was, well, we'll bring you city water, you know, from a public water treatment plant. But that's no trade because, well, you've got a water bill now.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's another thing to add into an already strapped budget for working folks.
Well, it gets even worse when I look at what preceded the mining initiative was, you know, essentially the state government, you know, the governor, cutting monies in the areas that helped elders and provided health care to poor people. You know, the way some of the blinders went on, renewable energies was cut. Wind farms were kind of poo-pooed by the Republicans, and those initiatives died downstate. One of the first things he did was he returned our stimulus money that would have put high-speed rail through southern Wisconsin, and that cost thousands of jobs, and that was, you know, our, of course, federal funds that would have stimulated the economy. But systematically, in almost this broad kind of continuum, it was as though poor people just kept getting the ratchets tightened down tighter and tighter and tighter, and then all of a sudden, as the blinders are pointing towards, you know, what's going on here, the hand with the Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA on the federal side of things to ensure that, you know, our homeland is protected. To that end, I can tell you that the EPA, as an example, is under tremendous political pressure from the mining companies and some of the, you know, the congressmen out in Washington that kind of answer to the beck and call of some of these corporate giants. I think, you know, writing all of our congressmen, no matter what state we're in, and voicing that support for the EPA and voicing our support for ecosystems, our groundwater aquifers, those types of things are the foundation of basic human rights that are essentially referred to as the commons, you know, clean air, clean water, that essentially the U.S. Constitution is based on. There is no life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness if your groundwater aquifers are poisoned and you're breathing poisonous air. When you think about what's going on nationally, and we're just a microcosm of it, you know, and with our challenge, federal programs like the EPA are unbelievably critical, and you know, they need to know that that they're supported so that they can approach their work with integrity. You know, that's one thought, and the other is, I mean, from a grassroots perspective, you know, we might get to the point where we need help to resist this stuff because this is that important to us. But I'm sure there are more local types of projects to become aware of and just advocate and try and wake people up to what's at stake. And I think we're at that point where environmentally versus some of the corporate initiatives, we need to make a choice. And we're seeing peoples, we're seeing communities, and we're seeing nature lose time and time again on some of these projects, you know.
Well, one of the things that occurs to me is that I know there's been a little bit of help here and there, but wouldn't it be beneficial to see this struggle get a little bit more attention from some of the big greens out there, Mike?
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting. I mean, as a small tribal government, you know, our whole mission is to meet the needs of our people within our little tribal nation up in you know, northern Wisconsin, there, the Bad River Band, Lakes, Chippewa. Some of that has been very difficult to, I guess, essentially, how you say it, build those connections. We're so engaged at the state and federal level, and with also trying to keep the grassroots movement locally within our tribe alive and going, that some of those types of connections to the bigger green, you know, groups that are out there are oftentimes overlooked due to the lack of, I guess you'd say, administrative capacity. And, you know, but we're getting started. You know, this has been a 2-year kind of legislative battle. And for us, we essentially summarize that as less than the blink of an eye, because we're ready to stand against, you know, our headwaters of our home being obliterated. We'll stand against that for the next 1,000 years if we have to, and we probably will.
I can't describe how much I admire that determination, Mike. Because there's something that I felt present while I was up there that was different from the struggle that I've been involved in, and that is that intergenerational quality that you just touched upon. This isn't a matter of protecting the present or protecting the future, but past, present, and future are all integrated in the view that you're taking of this, are they not?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, our foundational approach is the 7 generations perspective, you know, so that just essentially accounts for our actions and the way we approach our lands and waters through that filter 7 generations forward. But it's also an acknowledgement of all our ancestors that struggled and who essentially died preserving our home. It takes all of that into account, from our ancestors to the ones who are essentially temporary residents here on planet Earth, you know, those of us like you and I, Bob, that are walking the planet, and those babies that are still on their way, you know, and in some of our talks, that you know we've given from our community's perspective, we mentioned you know, from the Catholic perspective, we talk about the Alm, you know, the Hall of Souls, where all those souls that are still yet to be sent to planet Earth, you know, are down to Earth are kept. You know, their voices matter too, just as much as you know the ones in the past, and just as much as us here in the present who are essentially caretakers for what we have. And, you know, when you talk about mining, and I know you know full well what I'm talking about, the language that accompanies mining that the mining company doesn't want anyone to really use entails words like forever, perpetual maintenance, the impacts are so profound and so long-lasting, we start talking in a heartbeat, landscapes and waterways that are forever altered. And like Aldo Leopold, you know, wrote, you alter the land, you alter the people. We summarize it up real simply in Bad River, and what we've essentially said is, when you think of climate change and all those exotic invasives and these plants and these new diseases like viral hemorrhagic disease, septicemia, I should say, that hit the Great Lakes, all these encroachments that make taking care of our homes such a challenge, that even if left alone for an extractive industry, we are still going to have our hands full passing on the good things around us to those future generations out there. And it gets tragic in a hurry when you start thinking about mining companies that are going to obliterate the headwaters of watersheds and for people like us that are so interconnected with those waters and who depend on the groundwater aquifers that sit there in their infancy right in the footprint of the mining operations. You know, it's such that we have our hands full, and that the intergenerational approach that we look at acknowledges those babies that are yet to join us, but it definitely also acknowledges our forefathers, our ancestors that allowed us to be here, you know.
Well, indeed. And if we could take a few minutes, please, Mike, I've tried to convey a little bit of my just stunned amazement in seeing that countryside for the first time. For people who have never been to northern Wisconsin, and particularly for people who have never seen the Bad River or the Tyler Fork or the Pinoki Hills, could you just give us a little verbal snapshot of what that land is, and how it speaks to you, how it interfaces with your life?
Well, the Pinoki Mountains, sit to the south of Lake Superior, and they're hilly, forested hills that are untouched and relatively low in population. There's a couple of scattered small towns, but the cold springs, the small lakes, and the streams, creeks, and riverways that flow from those hills flow north down into a watershed and through, you know, our reservation and into Lake Superior. What's really interesting is that watershed is essentially a huge filter, a huge filtration system that cleanses and purifies, water for Lake Superior. Highlighted in that filtration system, I guess you'd say, is the northern tip of our reservation, which is essentially the Kokagon Sloughs wetland and the Bad River wetland. Together, these two systems that are essentially one big system comprise 40% of the wetlands on Lake Superior, and that is a huge wetland ecosystem that is internationally recognized for its pristine, unique, beautiful contributions to Lake Superior and to the, you know, to all of the animals, birds, migratory, flyways and everything else that come through it. It's also home to huge wild rice beds that produce an edible, grain rice for our people that is sacred culturally and that is a huge part of our identity. When I think about, you know, the Bad River and the Tyler Forks and some of these streams that come out of the Pinokis and flow to Lake Superior, what you really have is a garden of sorts that has a permaculture component that produces deer, trout, walleye, perch, high bush cranberries, wild rice, Labrador tea, maple syrup, clean drinking water, you know, in those groundwater aquifers I mentioned. It has everything intact, including all of the recognitions and accolades that go with unique places like this, Class A trout streams, outstanding resource waters, internationally acclaimed wetlands. It has the whole gamut of a very special place. You know, I heard one southern Wisconsin man tell me that Ashland County, the Pinoki Hills, and those waters that flow to Lake Superior and Lake Superior itself, he says, that's our Yellowstone. And this place has a food production component that allows people to live and really obtain a lot of wonderful traditional and seasonal foods and medicines that enhance their life. In addition to those notions of food production, those waterways provide, you know, recreation, spiritual connections, cultural connections, represent some sacred and powerful places that our tribal people are connected to. And when you get to the shore of Lake Superior on our reservation, what you will find is the absence of development. Our people have consciously chosen to leave our, you know, 8-9 miles of unbroken sandy white beaches free of development so that those future generations I mentioned essentially have the same view, can connect in the same way that our ancestors did 400 or 500 years ago. The very views as we walk down the beach on our home there, the open horizon, the wood line, the waterways, you know, they're essentially the same exact views that our ancestors would have had 400 or 500 years ago. And that type of connection, that type of understanding, and the desire to pass that on to tribal people that are going to be around 250 years from now is just unbelievably compelling. It's like if we do anything while we're here, you know, on this planet, preserving that, protecting that, and passing that on is just you know, one of our highest values as a people, and is one of our challenges that we rise to meet. And it's not free. You know, we have challenges. I you know, from sanitation and small communities, infrastructure needs. I mean, we sacrifice to keep our lands and waters the way they are. When I suppose other folks would see potential for condos and hotels and, you know, casinos and things like that, we consciously go the other way. Because we understand the power, the value, the upward value and the upward kind of trend of how places like where we live will become more and more scarce and more rare and more precious when we start looking through that filter of 50, 100 years, 200 years, 300 years. And that's, you know, the intergenerational perspective is built on a layer of understanding that we're going to be around another 1,000 years. And when you think about that, when we're going to be around another 2,000 years, it slows down this rush to blow up everything around us in order to extract and exploit whatever's there for short-term temporary profit.
All I can say, Mike, is amen, because I feel a deep connection to my forebears, as many people do here in Appalachia, and to hear you talk in the way you do inspires me, frankly, because carrying reverence for the previous generations in an effort to take them into future generations is the very essence of immortality, as far as I can tell. I'm getting email here from people simply saying thank you for having Mike on, and thank you for letting us hear this kind of point of view because it is so rare and so badly needed. I deeply want to find ways this is a severely underreported story, isn't it, Mike?
Well, we've had a difficult time, you know, getting our voice out, and you know, we've been doing all that we could do, you know, trying to get our state legislators to understand what's at stake has been very futile. There's been a lot of good legislators that have listened, and there was some really compelling, dramatic, and powerful testimony today from some of the Democratic senators. Senator Gail Schultz, you know, gave a very stirring talk against ABSB1 today here in the Madison Capitol. But, yeah, I think, you know, that's part of the strategy of fast-tracking legislation. You know, this is like, from many accounts, right out of, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council's playbook, you know, in terms of the type of legislation and the tactics used to promote it, you know. All I can say is what we're finally starting to discover in Bad River as we look to protect our home is that living in the shadow of that ore body in those hills doesn't have to be gloomy, so to speak, when you think about the threat of mining that's coming at us. That essentially, in celebrating, you know, the natural resources that we have, in going out and fishing, and going out and making wild rice and processing wild rice and tapping trees and making maple syrup and hunting and things like that, that actually that's all resistance. That's all fighting the mine and living a good life connected to the land and water. There's a chance to fight the mine right there in the way we do things. The other thing that has kind of risen up is prayer and ceremony. For us, it's Ojibwe ceremony, you know, Chippewa ceremony, same thing. Some of our traditional ways have been used more and more and more as we come together and center ourselves to talk and think about these things, you know, and to really slow down, chase money, chase time out of our space so that we can truly talk about the things that are at stake and what's around us. And really, that boils down to when you got extractive industry bearing down on you, that boils down to clean air, clean water, and babies. And, you know, those ceremonies are very powerful to just focus us in a good way on, you know, the things that we need as foundational pieces to.
Well, I could wax rhapsodic for hours on end about the impact that that area and the people that I got to meet, including you. I first met you down at Fighting Bob down in Madison. And it has been transformative for me, Mike. One of the first things Pete Rasmussen did, and Bill Hart, when I got up there, was to get me a big glass of water from one of the artesian wells. And you know, we've gotten real conscious of water here in West Virginia, because, well, for instance, what comes out of my tap tastes like a swimming pool, especially when it rains. It was so refreshing just to have that glass of clean, pure water that, Lord knows, had probably been percolating through the earth up there for how many thousands of years. When you take a moment and you put it in that kind of perspective, the very earth around you has a way of changing. I saw, and this is going to sound silly because you see them every day, I saw swans in the wild for the first time when I was up there. The only time I'd ever seen them were, you know, captive in a pond before. And believe you me, please, it was an incredibly different experience. And then the next to last day when I was up there for the first time and you asked me what we were doing the following day, and I told you we were going to go out and meet the Otaveros and see and see a little bit of the land, and told you that we were going to Lake Caroline, you impressed upon me the importance of really, really taking in the energy there at Lake Caroline, and I had something approaching a mystical experience when I did. We got there and I took my gloves off. It wasn't freezing cold, but it was a little bit colder than I'm used to. But I took my gloves off and I stuck my hands in the water of Lake Caroline right there where it becomes the Bad River. And it was the darndest thing. Now, that water was near freezing. I mean, there was already a sheen of ice out over the lake. And my hands in that water remained as warm as toast. And I pulled my hands out of the water, and I didn't shake them off or anything or rub them on my pants. They just dried there in the air around, and they never got cold.
That's awesome.
Oh, and I mean, I was goggle-eyed at that point. I was expecting, oh, dadgum, that's cold. Oh, gloves. You know, I was expecting to be doing something like that.
Yep.
But it just didn't happen, and I'm not a particularly religious man, as anybody in the Horn family can tell you, but I felt a sense of undeniable power that there's no getting around. And one of the things that inspires me the most is that I think if anybody can stop this, you and the Bad River Band and people of goodwill around you can stop it. And this, tell me if I'm wrong, but this legislative effort in the Wisconsin Assembly and Senate, this is not the end of anything, is it?
No, today is the beginning. You know, when the Senate passes a bill, it'll slide over to the Assembly, and the Assembly will be even less dramatic. They'll pass that quicker. Governor will sign it into law, and that marks the very beginning. Like I said, it hasn't even been the blink of an eye yet for our people. And our defenses is in the realm of treaty rights. You know, as a tribe, you know, we ceded some territory in exchange for you know, our homeland, and we kept reserved some rights on those lands that we ceded, you know, to hunt, fish, and gather. And destroying habitat, destroying waterways is a violation of our treaty rights through the destruction of habitat, which, you know, erodes those, they call them usufructuary rights that we reserved. But more than that, it boils down, like I said before, to human rights. You know, the Wisconsin Public Trust Doctrine sets forth, you know, all waterways and of Wisconsin being held in common by the citizenship. You know, so this has got the an affront to everybody, no matter what race or creed. You know, and for us in Bad River, for the groundwater aquifers underneath our home that we depend on, the recharge station where those water come from is up in the footprint of where they want to mine in the Pinoki Hills, and it's very simple. One of the ways we look at it, you know, Bob, is as human beings, you know, we are comprised of 70 to 75% water. That's physiological fact. That
we're about as much water in our bodies as the earth is itself.
Yeah, and you know, we acknowledge that although we may be the result of random stardust, as we live and breathe today, me here in Wisconsin and you in West Virginia, we are hardly comprised of random water. You are comprised of the groundwater aquifers or the waters around those parts of West Virginia where you're at. I am comprised of the, you know, primarily the groundwater aquifers underneath the Bad River Reservation. So when you start seeing law that allows a mining company to contaminate groundwater aquifers at depths deeper than 1,000 feet and not have to be accountable, quickly you can see that what they do to those groundwater aquifers, they do to our people. And all of a sudden, this specter of genocide and targeted impact to certain communities, certain peoples, starts to rise up. And, you know, we're going to take that all the way to the president's office, you know, for intervention if we have to. And This is only just the beginning today.
Well, I'm with you, and I know the Horn family now is with you every step of the way, Mike. I just got a note in from a dear friend out in the Pacific Northwest. She said, I, too, have chills. She said, it's just stunning. Would you please pass on to Mike that we just had an eagle fly over as you both were engaging in the needs of Mother Earth. We will be drumming this evening, aligning from the waters of the Puget Sound.
Oh, awesome.
It is powerful work you're doing. Another member of the Horn family, Betsy, who teaches school down in Texas, she said, when I told my students today that we need to think, because they're working on their alternative energy unit, she said, when I told my students today that we need to think 100 or 150 years into the future and save the planet for our great-grandchildren, one of my students asked why. He had no idea. Betsy concludes, Mike's voice is important. So please know, Mike, that you have and the people of the Bad River Band or the Lake Superior Chippewa have allies out here that may not have even been counted. And hopefully when the time comes for them to step up and to be counted and to make their names known in this struggle, that they will. And I think with the leadership that you're showing and the unity that you have helped create inside the Bad River Band and the outreach that you've done, for instance, to the other bands, the event that I was there at a couple of weeks ago at Lac Couturier shows that there is tremendous unity in this struggle, and it sounds like it is in fact growing all across Wisconsin, and I think it has potential to grow across the United States because I don't mean to get all soapboxy here, but for a long, long time, one of the people who have already gone on. Who was a leader of our movement, her name was Judy Bonds, told me when I first got involved with this struggle, she said, we have to stop it down here because it will grow inside West Virginia, it will grow inside Appalachia. And she stopped for a minute and she said, and Bob, one of these days they're going to figure out how to do mountaintop removal to other people outside of Appalachia. And I've seen every last bit of that come true, Mike. And the only way we stop it is if everybody understands that we are all potential victims of the, and I hate that word, I just hate that word, but we are all potentially impacted by these short-sighted people who can't see past the next quarterly profit and loss statement from Wall Street. We're all impacted by them upon that day that they set their eyes on us and say, you're next.
Yeah. Yeah, it's time for some serious reflection on the crossroads we seem to be at, the things that I say, you know, are in large part things that I hear from our community, our elders, and other tribes, you know, other Ojibwe tribes, and it's been an honor to just kind of pass on some of the worldview that is kind of around up in our home there. I think it's time for a paradigm shift. You know, there is a power and an importance that goes beyond dollars and cents when you look at watersheds, when you look at the important functions of those interconnected relations out there in the wild, you know. The Pinoki Mountains, as an example, one thing that no one ever even talks about is the cold water springs actually serve to regulate water temperature in the whole watershed. So in the heat of summer, big muskies and trout, they don't migrate out towards cold Lake Superior. They migrate higher up into the hills, into the shallows, because those cold water springs are there. And those trout and those muskie play an important role, you know, in the river way that is part of the whole food chain, and it just goes on down all the way to those macro invertebrates that we can't even see. You know, all those interconnected relations are important, and they are part, you know, I think Gaylord Nelson and some of the others summarized it, but our natural resources and those good things around us are the foundation for any notions of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, any notions of economic development. Without these things in place, that good life, you know, we call it the Matazilin in our, you know, in Ojibwe, that good life that we want to have are very, very, very difficult to you know, to get out and obtain and live. So, you know, chasing money out of the room and slowing down, you know, that little tornado that gets going in all of us is a couple of the ways we you know, through ceremony, talk about, you know, how we approach these things, you know, in our tribal reservation there. And, you know, there's an opportunity here. There's an opportunity, I think, for local governments, the bigger cities, the smaller towns, the families, you know, to think about how they approach those things around us. But I tell you, when you're staring down the barrel of an open pit mine and mountaintop removal, that stuff becomes so profound and it just, you know, gets to the point where it just fills the thoughts and kind of takes over everything and how we look at the world, you know. Everything looks all of a sudden fragile. And that fragility is also makes everything seem and look very precious. So,
indeed it does. Mike Wiggins, Jr., thank you very much for I hope I haven't taken up too much time in this conversation this evening.
Anything for you, Bob. I sure appreciate you coming and visiting us, and we're going to have you come back up north.
I want to come back to celebrate victory.
That'd be great.
And I think, and I've said it before, and I say it in all sincerity, I see a better chance for victory here than I have ever seen anywhere before. I use the word believe advisedly, but I believe that it can be had, and it is within reach. And I know that y'all aren't going to give up, and I know that you're going to persist. And I think at some point in time, the decency that you're bringing to bear has got to be, I don't know, it's got to be recognized within the universe itself. And I think that gives you a leg up. And my friends will do all we can.
Well, thanks so much, Bob. I appreciate that.
And well, one last thing. So are y'all down in Madison for a couple more days?
Most of us will be journeying back tonight and tomorrow morning.
Okay. Well, and by the way, pass my thanks along to the folks at Indian Country TV, because it was awfully good being able to watch some of the proceedings earlier today. You spoke very well, and the dance that we got to watch was, well, I got chills. I just got chills. And my wife was watching with me, and, well, she cries at things like that, and she did.
Wow.
But it was beautiful. So thanks for making it available for those who want to take part at a distance. Again, Mike, you have great heart in the struggle, and I thank you very much.
You bet, Bob. I'll pass that on to Paul DeMaine, and thank you for everything.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay.
Migwich. Mike Wiggins, Jr., tribal chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. I don't see what I could add that would be any more profound than what Mike has said. So we'll take a little break. Come back. Your phone calls, 304-658-3333. Your thoughts on this and other topics. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Flow. doesn't feel our one. Giant in the cold of the evening sun. Tomorrow's rain will wash the stains away. Something in our mind always stays. On and on, the rain will fall.
Second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Fifteen past the hour. Indeed, the second hour of tonight's Wednesday night edition of the Horn. You see now why I didn't want to do all the silly prayer meeting shtick? Never mistake the fact that I make fun of the right-wing religion industry for the notion that I am blind or deaf to the concept of spirituality. To me, they are two wildly, wildly different things. And frankly, I could unhop the mic and walk away and feel like I'd done my job tonight. it's kind of hard to move over into well, I'm reminded of the emails we've gotten from time to time from Kate, who variously has been from on the desert, on the Front Range, and at present is on the Gulf Coast. And she says, you know, I would far rather we spend our time talking about the things we need to talk about to make life better than talking about the personalities involved with sad, sorry, tawdry American politics. And it's in moments like this that I understand completely what she's been talking about. I was changed. I was changed going up there. And I don't want to make it sound like, you know, the heavens opened up and someone, just some bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky spoke to me. But when you get enough of the debris of modern life shoved to one side and you understand that we do not, with all of our gadgets and gimcracks and bric-a-brac, we do not define the meaning of life worth living. When you get a handle on the idea that life has been worth living for a lot of people for a lot of time, when you understand that it took the onset of the Industrial Revolution to move a man to write in English that for most people life is nasty, brutish, and short, you begin to understand a little bit. Things, the fog sort of dissipates. Can you imagine, because I am familiar by virtue of past reading and interests. I'm familiar with some more ancient people's take on life. And nasty, brutish, and short is not the way they described it. It takes the rise of remorseless capitalism, trading money for the value of human existence, to make life nasty, brutish, and short. Because it isn't in its essence. It does not take a 72-inch widescreen, flat screen, 240-hertz television to yield quality in life. It takes perspective and prioritization. And, well, I think you get the idea. Dr. John just wrote in a few minutes ago. He said, I'm all fired up after that interview. Damn, Bob, the hell with Wisconsin government. If people like Mike Wiggins are involved, the Ojibwe can win this. He continued, he said, I know I'm doing something right. I put out a Twitter flurry during that interview with Chairman Wiggins, and I got some derpy right-wing mind consultant tweeting bullshit back at me. I call that a win. Hot damn. Mind consultant. Destruction consultant. Poisoning consultant. One of the things that I admire about Mike Wiggins is the fact that he will not hesitate to use the G word. And I get the idea from past conversations that he came to the use of the word genocide reluctantly. I don't think anybody wants to contemplate it. But in fact, that ain't an iron ore mine in the Pinoki Hills. That's a genocide mine. The geology is shocking. The layer of pyrite fools gold, ironically enough, that they'll have to go through. You know, pyrite is a sulfide. It's a sulfurous molecule. And when you go blasting the bejesus out of it, it does get into the water. And none of these mining company fools can guarantee that it won't. And none of these mining company fools can guarantee that those same micro-miniaturized particles of silica that I was talking about last night, you know, the particles that are as small as a virus that look under a microscope like broken glass. None of those mining consultants, none of those mining engineers can guarantee that after they set off their monumental charges of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, that not one speck of that filth will get into the lungs of some child in the cradle on the Bad River lands, or won't get into the lungs of a farmer's cattle a mile away from the Pinoki Hills. If they could guarantee it, you could look at them and say, all right, everybody that votes for this, y'all just move right there. We'll get the housing development started. Right to the foot of the mine. You move right there. You live there day in and day out. You drink that water. You breathe that air. And then maybe we'll believe that you can keep the poisoning from taking place. But you see, they won't. And if you ask them to give you a 100% guarantee, they say things like, well, nothing... Sorry, wrong accent. They'll say things like, well, nothing in life is 100% guaranteed. Except death. And the whole point is that this nightmare in northern Wisconsin will be a perpetuator of early death. We know it. We don't suspect it. We know it. The science is there. It's peer-reviewed. It doesn't necessarily have to do with coal. It has to do with all the damn blasting. Look at the tiniest thing. Get a grain of sand. Look at that tiny thing and understand that the stuff that gets pumped into people's lungs around these operations is infinitesimally smaller than that. But smaller though it may be, it bioaccumulates. And once it's in, you can't spit it out. One of the senators who will vote in favor of the so-called new mining bill in Wisconsin represents the area where the Lac Coeur d'Alene reservation is. And he's already taken $106,000. I think it's $106,000 from the mining company. They have passed out buku money and don't think that they're going to be real scrupulous with their adherence to environmental standards, because they got to recoup that loss, and they'll recoup it on the backs of people who live downwind and downstream of it. But there's going to be jobs, right? That's a good point, Marty. Marty says, you know, those particles can wreck a jet engine. Why would anybody want to breathe it? Wreck a jet engine, wreck a lung, wreck a heart, wreck a genitourinary system, wreck a liver, wreck a pancreas, wreck a gallbladder, wreck a brain, wreck a person. So we are coming up on the halfway mark of this evening's program. I had other stuff. I have other stuff in the stack to talk about, but I'm moved. I am moved. We will move on. It would be, and of course, this being conversation radio and everything, it is driven by your thoughts and your ideas. The lines are open at 304-658-3333. 304-658-3333. We still have a goal of reaching, getting our 800 number out of the hostage situation. That may be a while yet. By the way, thanks go out to Janie. Thank you, Janie. Janie finished up last night's challenge from Sal and got us started on tonight's fundraising. Much appreciated, Janie, indeed. Yeah, that's a good idea, Marty. Instead of going negative, let's celebrate a little bit of courage before we wander off into the underworld of right wingery. Let's celebrate some courage. Via Digby, over at her Hullabaloo blog, piece by piece, that life support system for a haircut, Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity, at some point, I think Keith Ellison held up a pair of buttocks and said, Sean, are these yours? Because he did. He handed him his butt. Hopefully, the courage that Keith Ellison has will prove to be quite contagious, although I hold out, I'm not overly hopeful of that happening, but it sure is nice when it happens. It had to do with Keith Ellison being invited onto the life support system for a haircuts program, I guess to explain why Barack Obama is not a terrorist or something. Like, yeah, I mean, you know how they are. Just check it out.
Now, with some insight, Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota. Congressman, welcome back, sir.
You bet.
I guess that's what we could describe as staying on message, something the Democratic Party, I would argue, is very good at. Let me ask
you're pretty good at it, too.
Thank you.
You know, quite frankly, you are the worst excuse for a journalist I've ever seen.
This I am
absurd,
the what?
Get him!
I can't hear you.
You heard me. What you just displayed was not journalism. It was yellow journalism. It wasn't anything close to trying to tell the American people what's really going on. And, I mean, it's just shocking. When the Republicans, your party, which you shamelessly
represent... I'm not a Republican. Let me correct the record.
You are nothing but a Republican.
I am not a registered Republican.
You are a shill for the Republican Party.
I am a registered conservative,
sir. And you alibi them constantly. You alibi them 100% of the time.
Keep going.
You
keep ranting. Let me ask you a question. I've given you plenty of time to rant, Congressman.
Wait.
This is precious. The white guy explains to the brown guy that he's given him plenty of time. Oh, thank you, white man, for giving time. You generous, generous soul, you. Shall we go back?
Let me ask you a question.
As a matter of fact,
Congressman, let me ask you a question.
What I think is right.
Why are you so angry? You're so angry. Let me ask
you
a question.
Why are you so
angry? I'm not angry. I'm laughing at you.
Oh, he's an angry black man. If you were listening, Sean, then again, life support systems for haircuts seldom have functioning ears. If you were listening, Sean, you'd understand that he's angry, if angry is the appropriate word. Well, he's not angry. He is doing something that no one has had the courage to do to you in a very long time. Explain to you that you are what we call here in the hills and hollers of Appalachia, oblivet. Oblivet is 10 pounds of feces in a 5-pound onion sack. That's oblivet. Sean Hannity is oblivet.
Yeah, because I think this is actually comical.
I'm laughing at you.
All right, here's my question. Here's my question for you.
And it's not the first time.
Spirit of bipartisanship. Let's find a dialogue. I want to ask you this.
I thought you weren't a Republican.
Max, I'm a registered conservative. I am,
yeah,
sir,
right.
You want to make a $1,000 bet that I'm a registered conservative? You want to make a $10,000 bet?
I don't bet.
I'm just telling you.
Sean. Shh. Don't tell Sean Hannity. Representative Ellison is a follower of Islam. They're forbidden from gambling. But we wouldn't expect Sean Hannity to actually have any of that cultural sensitivity stuff, because, you know, that's all candy ass, right?
I'm a registered conservative. I wrote a book called Conservative Victory. Is it immoral?
I'm
immoral? What did I do that's immoral? I didn't do anything that's immoral.
You say things that aren't true.
He didn't add $6 trillion to the debt since he's been president?
No.
We did add $6 trillion to debt since he's been president.
What about the other 10? Right. Let's talk about the other 10.
Congressman, you are a total waste of time. I'm moving on because our audience deserves better. Thank you for being with us. I tried to give you a fair shot. And coming up.
No, you didn't.
Did ABC News...
No, you didn't. Ain't no fair shots happen on Fox. You want to make a bet? Now, compare what you heard, and Digby posted this over at Digby's blog.blogspot.com. Texas Betsy sent this along. Smelling salts alert. Keith Ellison was very, very rude to that nice man, Sean Hannity. Digby writing, oh my goodness, someone needs a fainting couch stat. Because apparently that outfit that Charlie Pierce refers to as Tiger Beat on the Potomac, Politico, said that Representative Ellison exploded. And said and accused Representative Ellison of everything short of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping when you get right down to it. But Democratic Representative Keith Ellison attacked Fox News host Sean Hannity. Really? Attacked? A man dares to speak truth to the powerful Fox white man, and it's an attack. How many articles do you suppose Politico and who is this neo maxi zoom dweeby Dylan Byers? How many articles do you suppose Dylan Byers over at Politico has written on the number of times that the life support system for a haircut has attacked, I tell you, various and sundry Democrats? Now, see, the for-profit media, especially the neo-maxi-zoom dweebies inside the Beltway, like, how did I forget his name so quickly? Maybe because he's forgettable. Dylan Byers. They only think it's an attack if someone from the Democratic Party is doing it. Representative Ellison began the interview by calling Hannity the worst excuse for a journalist I've ever seen. Hannity calmly endured the attacks from the Minnesota congressman and tried in vain to assure him that he was not a registered Republican, but rather a registered conservative. What the f*** is a registered conservative? the congressman's remarks came after Hannity aired footage of President Obama giving two similar interviews about the looming effects of sequestration, set against a soundtrack of O Fortuna from the Carmina Burana. Carl Orff, isn't that? You know O Fortuna, right? It's one. You hear it all the time. It is. It's one of those stirringly ominous kind of yeah. Let's see if I can get it here. Yeah, this looks like it. Yeah, that's sure enough some Obama music, isn't it? That's what we're going to play when we're marching the life support system for a haircut off to the FEMA re-education camps. You might notice that that's Latin. That's because Carl Orff did not write the lyrics. In point of fact, and this is just one of those little cultural moments we do here, the Carmina Burana is a manuscript of 254 poems and dramatic texts, mostly from the 11th or 12th century, although some are from the 13th century. They're mostly bawdy, irreverent, and satirical, written principally in medieval Latin, a few in Middle High German, and some with traces of Old French or Provençal. And some are just a hodgepodge of all of the above. They were written by monks. The whole thing was discovered in 1803 in a Benedictine monastery in Oberbayern, Bavaria. Carl Orff set it all to music, or some of them, 24 of the poems, were set to music in 1936. Let's see if we can find... a translation of O Fortuna, that very, very ominous-sounding Obama destroying capitalism music. O Fortuna, velut luna, statu variabilis, semper crescis, aut decrescis, vita destabilis, nunc obdurat et tunc curat, ludo mentis aciem. Okay, that's me just showing off reading Latin poorly. O fortune, like the moon of ever-changing state, you are always waxing or waning. Hateful life now is brutal. Well, I just got shown up that whole business about nasty, brutish, and short. No, the monks of medieval Germany were thinking pretty poorly about life too. Then again, it was medieval Europe. Yeah, nasty, brutish, and short. Brought to you by white folks. O fortune, like the moon of ever-changing state, you are always waxing or waning. Hateful life is now brutal, now pampers our feelings with its game. Poverty, power, it melts them like ice. Fate, savage and empty, you are a turning wheel. Your position is uncertain. Your favor is idle and always likely to disappear. Covered in shadows and veiled, you bear upon me too. Now my back is naked through the sport of your wickedness. The chance of prosperity and of virtue is not now mine. Whether willing or not, a man is always liable for fortune's service. At this hour, without delay, touch the strings, because through luck she lays low the brave. All join with me in lamentation. That was what century? Yeah, 11th or 12th century. The High Middle Ages, when the church was at its zenith, ruling prince and pauper alike, and enforcing a vision of a life barely worth the living. Our buddy the Angry Indian. Yes, play O Fortuna every time the GOP is mentioned. Yeah, and not just any monks. Wine and beer making monks at that, he notes. Okay, a little clarity here. Registered conservative. Jack in Shreveport noting, apparently one can register that way in New York. Yes, okay. And Marty confirming the same. Really? Hannity lives in New York? I would have thought him for a Connecticut boy. No. Goes to show. Let's stop shilly-shallying about and go forthwith to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy. What's up, man?
Too much. That was probably one of the best clips of Keith Ellison I've heard in a long time.
He's welcome to do more as far as I'm concerned.
I wish he'd take down all of those punks one by one. It's easily done. They're all just empty suits, big talkers, and that's where it ends. And Sean has the gall and the balls to come out and say that Keith Ellison's staying on point. What does Sean Hannity do his whole career?
Yeah,
he stays on point. He won't back down. He spreads lies over and over again. Even when he's proven wrong, he'll say, "Oh, that's incorrect. It's incorrect. That's all he can say."
Well, he sat there and how many years did he sit there abusing poor Alan Colmes?
Wiping his feet on
him night after night after night.
Well, he was there for that purpose. He was easy to slam because Alan Colmes obviously had his place. He wasn't to make Sean Hannity look stupid. That was his place. But yes, Sean did do that for years and years and years. At least finally Alan sort of got in the way, even though he still kind of does the same thing by himself now.
Yeah, Sean Hannity is everything that Representative Ellison said. He is a shill. He's a mouthpiece, and nothing more. He has the ethics of a dysentery bearing amoeba.
Well, he's clearly ignorant too. Asking Keith if he wanted to place a bet on that when everyone knows that Muslims and people of that faith don't bet or, for the most part, don't drink wine or liquors.
Yeah, the only thing he could have made it better, I'll bet you a beer.
Right. Yeah, that or you want to bet $10,000.
See, the only way Keith could have made that better was to say, I'm not going to gamble with you, Sean, because you still got an outstanding bet to settle up getting waterboarded.
Yeah, exactly.
And
and
that thing's only, half a decade old.
I'm embarrassed that Sean Hannity spends his Christmases here in Vermont. he's a piece of work. But, hey, I wanted to spread something else to everyone out there that I told to Malloy the other night, and people probably heard this, and maybe you have, maybe you haven't. I was wondering, does West Virginia use plate readers yet?
What?
Plate readers, have you ever heard of them?
I live under a rock and everything, but maybe we do, and I just don't understand the term.
Okay, plate readers are essentially a drone mounted to a police car. There's four readers on all four corners of the car, and they can read license plates as they drive down the street. They can pick up to 7,000 up a minute, no joke.
I haven't heard of that, but that doesn't mean they're not here.
Well, they're here in Vermont, and they're moving them out in test areas, but supposedly these test cars are just here for testing.
To what end?
To what end? They're collecting data on everyone again, but it's for your protection because they can solve crimes and statistics more and more. all this stuff is going into a national database, just like all this stuff that they are picking off Verizon Wireless and AT&T and all the other stuff. In fact, now there's actually an app for that too. And I mean that in kind of a sarcastic way. Now police, when they're in their car doing their things, whether it's good or not, they can pull up your license plate, look into the database, and wherever you've been seen and your license plate has been snapped, they can bring up photos of your car and where you were, GPS everything on your car when they got you on their license plate reader.
Oh, nice. I can't wait.
I think, again, Mike said that he couldn't go to sleep that night thinking about that, and he thanked me for it. But, yeah, basically it's that. And I don't know who it was. It was 60 Minutes Dateline, one of those type programs that did a short, small piece on it that said that people have pressed freedom of information on these because it goes to an area, information is stored, but the intelligence agencies, police, you name it, won't name how long it stays there and what it's used for.
Oh, that's just beautiful.
Yeah, and like I said, Vermont started out with like one for a test car about 9 months ago, and they said it was just going to be a test. Now every department of state has one of these frickin' things.
Oh, brother. And so at some point in time, I guess you can theorize that this is the next step from traffic cams, so that this plate reader can in turn maybe be joined with a laser-based speed detection device and just issue tickets.
I think that's where it's going. Like I said, this system is already set up in the fact where it's tied into, like, traffic cams and stuff like that. Traffic cams, when they take a picture of license plate. So, again, they can see where you've been, at what time, what person's city is, how often you were seen on camera. Whatever your plate was snapped, they can pull it up from just knowing your license plate number now. And it comes up from a national database from California to Maine.
Wow.
And this is just another step of the drone process. It was one of those things that people kind of turned a blind eye to and said, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. It can't affect me. They couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah, they'll continue thinking that until they get a letter in the mail saying, please send us $500. We busted you at 1:16 p.m. on February the 28th doing 29 in a 25.
And that already happens to some extent. People do get traffic tickets from anonymous traffic cameras in cities when they go through red light, or some of them are sophisticated enough where they can pick up your speed, too.
Jeez.
So that was to give you a break from the guy that spoke earlier, Mike, I think is his name.
Yeah.
That was awe-inspiring to hear someone speak like that. I love nothing more than to hear Native Americans speak on a variety of subjects because they know so much more than we want to think we'll ever know. They're open to so much more, not so much in terms of, like you said, like a God, but in spirituality. They understand way more. And it's just something wonderful to always hear.
Well, and it's deeply inspiring to be around the people involved in this struggle, whether they be Native or white folks or anybody else, people who have the nerve to stand. It takes a lot of guts, Jeremy, to stand up to a multi-billionaire, because you understand that that multi-billionaire can squash you like a bug, and to see people when they just say, you know, I don't care, we're right, they're wrong, we're gonna do what we think is necessary for the perpetuation of our lives, not theirs. Because see, and I know it marks me as naive, Jeremy, but honest to God, if you've got $1.7 billion, what don't you have that $1.7 billion won't buy you?
More money. I know, but yes, I can still buy you more money if you buy the right companies. But I think that's basically their idea. It's a greed scam.
Yeah.
At some point, once you have enough money, your money makes money without doing a goddamn thing. And that's what billionaires do. They make money just sitting around.
Yeah, so again, you got $1.7 billion, let it lay around and turn into $2 billion. You don't need to blow up. You don't need to blow up the only home that a few thousand people have. Right.
Right. Right. And I, and we've all got a dog in this fight. The lunatic we're doing about mountaintop removal, coal mining, you name it. We've all got a dog in this fight. I said a long time ago on the show that today the water you drink, the dinosaurs took a dump in 25 million years ago. The same water. It won't go away. And once it's polluted, it's destroyed forever. You can't really clean it out.
Exactly.
Without running it through caustic, other chemicals like chlorine and stuff. And then again, it's never really truly pure water again. It is a finite element to some extent. Once it's gone, it will be gone.
Yeah, you can render it useless.
Right, you can render it towards the stuff you were talking about in those coal ash dams last night, which sound pretty horrific in their own nature.
Check out this. This is a quote from a book that I've been reading. I read an excerpt from it a couple of nights ago. It's called Altered Carbon by Richard K. Morgan. The corporates do whatever turns a profit. Don't let your prejudices blind you. Sure, they'll burn down entire villages if it pays, but if having a human face is what cuts it, they'll whip out a human face and put it on. And that's what they do when they tell these lies to desperate people, say, like in Iron County, Wisconsin. Well, we're going to bring you jobs. You're going to have jobs. And people say, what? We're going to have jobs? Oh, yeah, real good jobs. $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year job. Lots of jobs. Well, bring the jobs. Screw the mountains. Screw the water. You know what? We can buy water. And in that moment, you realize that, well, they're not really tuned in or tapped into the reality of the closed loop that this earth is that you just described, Jeremy.
I know. That movie, I'm trying to think, Gasland from a couple of years ago, a documentary about the people who...
Yeah, Josh Fox.
Yeah, get all excited about the $1,000 a month for however many years. They don't realize that money goes away, and they're going to spend that money to maintain their life, not their lifestyle, but just common elements around their house once the oil companies pick up their drills and leave their mess. And just leave them to rot and decay in those chemical fields?
Yeah.
It's only a finite amount. I mean, I know people in this state themselves that have taken deals from companies like Verizon or AT&T to put a tower up on their hill because it's higher than everything else. And it's a lease for so long, but they're living there with the radioactive fallout of a cell phone tower their whole life. But it's worth to them the couple hundred thousand dollars it is for the 25-year lease, but they don't realize the whole time they're being poisoned.
And imagine, never mind a cell tower. Imagine a toxic pit, a half a mile wide, 1,000 feet deep, 22 miles long, over the course of 40 years.
Held up by rocks and dirt, too, nonetheless.
Well, yeah, and the stuff that they blow away has to go somewhere, and their plan for it is just to dump it in the Bad River watershed. Just fill it up. You know, hell, that's just a swamp. That's why I've taken to sort of stepping back when I say that we're going to wander off into the right-wing swamp. Swamps have a purpose.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, so, I don't know, you know, we'll have to change that to, like, wander off into the... into the right-wing wasteland or something.
We should revise that, though, because natural swamps made by nature serve a purpose and they're a beautiful thing. Man-made swamps are heinous.
Yeah, yeah,
natural
exactly.
Natural swamps provide lots of land and lots of creatures, a place to live and thrive, even though we don't go there because there's mosquitoes and they bite us and stuff like
that.
Well,
no, human beings have survived there quite well, thank you very much, for quite some several thousands of years.
And that's proven, I know, because, like, there's stories of, like, the bogmen from Great Britain and places like that, which are essentially swamps, but they found their bodies after many hundreds of years because they've been pretty much mummified by the chemicals in the bog.
Right, because the bogs themselves are, oxygen-free environments. And over in Denmark as well. That's how we know a little bit about the sacrificial ritual. It's posited as being sacrificial ritual. It may have just been an asshole that they found the guy with a leather cap on his head who had been garroted and thrown in the bog. Naturally, the scientists speculate, well, obviously, this was a religious ritual. He could have been an asshole.
Yeah, he could have been. You're right. He could have just been someone killing someone. I was going to say, I'll leave you with one more kind of funny. It's an odd topic, but I'll leave you with it. I have heard a story that another right-wing talker, Glenn Beck, took on the WWE.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up because it's kind of on the radar. This is about as bizarre as it gets, isn't it, Jeremy?
It's freaking hilarious, Bob. Glenn Beck came out and said, to the extent that, and I'm a fan, so it would offend me and offend a lot of fans probably. I mean, I'm a fan of the product. I understand that there's average watchers and there's people who watch it and understand the product. If you understand the product, it becomes even more entertaining than just passerby stuff.
Well, that's the same thing. The second hour announce voice is my buddy Brian Reznor, and he's a big fan, and he's the one who told me about this. That WWE created this character who's virulently anti-immigrant, you know, typical right-wing, you know, redneckistan kind of guy, and what? Glenn Beck took offense?
Glenn Beck took offense at his character because this character is pretty much, he would be almost like, he's almost like that guy from Looney Tunes with a big rim hat, a cowboy, kind of a redneck guy.
Oh, you mean Yosemite Sam?
He is him with more colorful language that's PG-13 because WD doesn't push as much as they used to. But this guy is pretty much vehemently like anti-immigrants. And of course, companies like WWE, TNA, other companies, they employ people from other countries to draw in talent. So like right now, one of the storylines is this guy is against a guy from Mexico because he's coming here to take jobs that other Americans can do. But the funny rebuttal to this story was, I don't know if your friend got to this, was that the two guys that portray these characters that Glenn Beck was taking offense to, essentially, they cut a promo at Glenn Beck, and halfway through the promo, they stepped aside to third person. Basically, they removed the characters they're playing and gave their full real name and everything, so we portray characters, Mr. Beck. And they went into a long rant after Glenn Beck. It was fair. They weren't mean to him. And in the end, they offered him a chance when they were in Texas. It was going to be, I think it was past Monday, they were in Texas, right near his compound where he produces his halfway TV show for DirecTV. And they offered him a 5-minute rebuttal to come down into the audience in the ring and speak back to them. He wouldn't take it. So they took it to another step. They sent two of their announcers to his compound to try to get every pace with him, and he threw everything he could at them. Security, building owners, you name it. Get away, get away, get away. He can't stand up to fire what it's put back on him, just like Hannity can't. Hannity kicks people off and says, oh, we had enough of you because I can't take it. Same.
Well, I find it fascinating that Glenn. Well, you know, nobody's ever going to accuse Vince McMahon of being some liberal.
No, he's not angelic. Look what he spent for his wife to try to win a Congress seat. But at the same point, Glenn Beck is not going to turn his listeners away from the WWE. His listeners that watch the WWE will stop listening to his ass. That's what's going to happen. The WWE is a company that does not lose historically.
No. This is fascinating because, I mean, I guess after years and years and years of controlling his own microphone, Jeremy, the Beckerhead has come to the conclusion that everybody else will accord him the same same tender mercies as he accords others. Did he not understand that he was getting into a fight with Vince McMahon and that Vince McMahon is not going to play fair? And of course, the whole backstory on this, you know, the idea that Glenn Beck would be offended by a character created in the midst of a WWE, what would we call this storyline?
Right.
I find to be hilarious in its entirety.
They are characters and nothing more. I'll give you another good example to prove this point, and everyone that's educated in the subject would know that, and I think most people would realize this. There's a guy who's probably one of the more famous wrestlers of our current time, and he's kind of older now. He's named The Undertaker. A number of years ago, I have a friend who's a law enforcement officer here in Vermont, and they were putting on a show here in Burlington. And they got a call to a room in the middle of the night saying there's some loud, ruckus people in the room. The officer showed up, and it was this guy named The Undertaker. Out of character, his name's Mark. I forget what it is. Doesn't matter. But anyway, real nice guy. Super nice. Really friendly. Said, I'm sorry, officer. Sorry to come out. I'm not trying to cause any trouble. I just mind myself. And shook the guy's hand, signed an autograph. And in the end, he said, you know, by the way, I'm a lawyer by career. I just do this because it's where I found a good place to make money because of my size.
Yeah.
But a lot of these guys are way more educated than they portray their characters as. Way more educated.
Oh, sure. Whoever it is that's playing that Tiger character, I don't know what his politics are, but you can't just do that. I mean, it takes some work for an otherwise intelligent human being to come across as being as dumb as a teabagger.
And that's part of the art form. Like I said, if you're an educated fan, you see it from a different perspective of, say, like maybe a 5-, 6-, 7-year-old. You understand it. And it's part of the involvement. You understand these characters. You can dissect them once you understand that. So I just think it's really funny to hear the Beckerhead come out, speak on a subject he clearly has no knowledge of, from another ignorant stance, and attacks them for it, not realizing probably that Vince McMahon has beat the IRS. He's beat people in a court. He ruled that whole empire with an iron fist, not like in sort of a way, but he is a monopoly that cannot be stopped. Because he's...
Yeah, it's an entertainment franchise.
Right, he's so good at what he does. And the fact that there's so many fans out there that it's kind of like NASCAR. NASCAR used to be kind of a taboo thing, sort of wrestling, but now it's become so much more famous because of people like Stone Cold, for instance. It opened up to a whole new landscape of people, but these people have no idea what they speak about. They just continuously put their foot in their mouth.
Well, it's not that they put their foot in their mouth, Jeremy, that surprises us. It's the eternal wonderment of how they're going to get the second one in there with it.
Well, we're just hoping it's the rope before the foot in the mouth, so that day's coming. Glenn's going to lose it all one day, and he's going to off himself. It's coming. Mike's right.
I hate to be hateful, but, I won't be draping the car with bunting when he does.
And hopefully he doesn't take other innocents with him, but it's going to come one of these days. He's going to slip up and not be able to take it, just like probably Rush will, and maybe even little Hannity will.
Oh, I saw the funniest graphic today. A buddy of mine sent it to me on Facebook. It was obviously a Photoshop job, but it was a picture of Andy Kaufman holding a sort of limp Rush Limbaugh mask in front of an American flag. And it's got a Fox News banner under it, and it says, "Alert, Rush Limbaugh a fraud?" And the caption says, "Rush Limbaugh revealed to be 30-year-long Andy Kaufman prank."
That would be Andy Kaufman style, though. That would be funny.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Well, Bob, have a good night. Just want to drop some of those more scary and funny stories on you, but it's ironic out there. Definitely there's a god. It is the god of irony.
Yeah, we just have to be careful with her because she is a god of irony, and that doesn't mean that we are immune to her work.
Oh, I definitely take that into account, but still, some of those people have to be called out for their trash.
Yeah, in fact, Marty just sent me the story. WWE tries and fails to interview Glenn Beck after showing up at his studio. The headline says it all, Marty says. Coward.
And that's what I said when I reposted the story myself to my timeline. I just said, typical coward. That's all I have to say because he can dish it, but he sure can't take it when they come to get a fair one-on-one interview about their product with him.
Yeah, Jim just wrote in and said, I'd love to see the Fox boys in a Ric Flair outfit with all the tights and everything hit the mats. Jake the Snake and The Undertaker in a fight cage.
It never happened. They'd kill him in real life.
Well, I'd go, my eyeballs would burn out of my head if the life support system for a haircut walked out in tights. There's just some things in this world well, that were, you know, that were meant not to be seen.
Isn't that true?
Then again,
go ahead, Bob.
All right, Jeremy, you have a good night.
You too, thanks. Bye.
Bye. Our good buddy Jeremy calling from Vermont. Lines are open, 304-658-3333. We can take all comers on this, using a sort of wrestling metaphor. Lots of notes coming in about plate readers. Bill wrote in and said, yeah, tell me again how far off Orwell was. I don't think I've ever told anybody that Orwell was off the mark. It's right there. The story Texas Betsy sent along, debate over license plate readers grows in Maryland. Oh, Jesus. And, of course, there are already in places like Washington State, for instance, intersections that have cams targeting cars moving through traffic. Even a second late, they'll ding you. And here's the fun part. It's all outsourced. I mean, if you're getting a ticket from Officer Friendly, at least you're getting a ticket from Officer Friendly. But, for instance, if you get dinged with one of these traffic cams in Washington State, you have to deal with people in Arizona, of all places. You know, Arizona, Jan Brewer, Hatchet Face, Arizona, Teabagger, Immigrant Militia, Papers Please, Arizona. Jesus. And a lot of people get intimidated and they just pay up. Because it's hard to fight somebody in Arizona when you're in Washington, right? By the way, going back to Sean Hannity's membership in the Conservative Party USA really does exist. News Ninja Gene sent along their homepage. Our mission is to reestablish the limits and boundaries of government as framed by the founding fathers of the United States of America, in God we trust. The Conservative Party firmly embraces, firmly, huh? Wait a minute. We're having some grammar problems here, and I was about to read right into it, and the Conservative Party, the Conservative Party firmly embraces in the concept of American exceptionalism. They embrace in the concept of American exceptionalism, but they do not embrace in the concept of American grammaticalism or syntacticalism. Anarcho-syntacticalists. Wouldn't that be interesting? America is a country of a distinguished founding, unique historical experience, and has a grand path to the future. We also believe the United States has contributed more to the political, economic, and financial betterment of the human condition than any previous collection of what? Our party's platform reflects this belief. The Conservative Party supports comprehensive immigration policies that are enforceable, pass constitutional muster, and do not reward or encourage lawlessness. Read as law, for lawlessness, you can just sort of read in brown people. The Conservative Party strongly supports the Second Amendment of the Constitution, which stipulates that a well-regulated militia is necessary for the security of free state, and that the rights of all law-abiding U.S. citizens to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. CPUSA further understands the right to bear arms is inherent in the right to individual self-defense, the defense of the family, protection of private property, and the preservation of traditional hunting rights. Protection of private property. That means they want to be able to shoot people for, you know, stealing the silverware. Second Amendment was also designed to protect the people against the tyranny of federal government and to help preserve the independence of this nation. Oh, Jesus, I'm going to stop before I vomit. What a bunch of freaks. No surprise that that would be Sean Hannity's party. So you get the idea now of that conservative. But I am not a Republican. No, Republicans are too damn liberal for you, Sean. Texas Betsy has it about right on. They want to shoot people to defend family values. Speaking of which, another one of those stories today. Out of New Hampshire and Connecticut. Jesus, this is sad. Megan sent this along. Just another lawful gun owner, until she wasn't. Dateline, North Stonington, Connecticut. What led a grandmother to kill her two young grandsons and then take her own life? That's what police, as well as family and friends, are trying to make sense of. We're faring. We're sad. This hit really close to home this time, said Christine Hare, the owner of Kids and Company Daycare. Emotions are running high at Kids and Company Daycare in North Stonington. At 2:30 Tuesday afternoon, 47-year-old Deborah Dennison picked up her grandsons, 6-month-old Ashton Perry and his older brother Alton, who turned 2 yesterday. The arrangement was she was going to spend some time with the boys, and then they were going to meet up later with Brenda and Jeremy for a family party, said Nikki Salon, a daycare center director. We knew her. We knew how she was. We'd go through our minds now. Is this something we could have picked up but nothing? Never did they imagine what would happen instead. A suicide note alerted the boys' parents that they were in danger, sparking a statewide Amber Alert, which would end in tragedy. There were bodies found in Dennison's van next to Lake of Isles in Preston at 9:30 Tuesday night. Police believe Dennison shot the boys and then turned the gun on herself. I was shocked. Yeah, it's a horrible thing. My heart goes to the family for what has happened. Just awful. Those poor children, said Colleen O'Connor. She lives across the street from Ms. Dennison in Stonington. Andrea Kane, a neighbor, said, I mean, not to sound like a jerk, but if you want to take your own life, go for it. Two innocent, beautiful boys. That's terrible. Terrible. Jesus. Of course, New Hampshire is another one of those places where they practically put firearms in gumball machines. Because, you know, they're protecting freedom in case the government becomes tyrannical. Never mind the fact also that you've got some incredibly, ridiculously elevated chance of someone you love or yourself being harmed by a firearm you own than you do of it, than any chance you have of using it to protect yourself or your loved ones. That's just an established fact. She's a lawful gun owner. Until she wasn't. That's the problem with being a lawful gun owner. You are until you aren't. Might need to elaborate on this a little bit, Ray. Ray says it's funny how Christians run away from anything Jesus ever said about violence or self-defense. Yeah, they don't want anything to do with that. In fact, there's a story brewing, or a, you know, one of those phony baloney, faked up, ginned up, dummied up, rubed up controversies. This being prayer meeting, we can use the story. Riffing on the thematic concept of Django Unchained, this past weekend, Saturday Night Live ran a skit called The Jesus Uncrossed. And the tagline for it, it was a movie, you know, it was like a movie promo. He's risen from the... Let's do this right. He's risen from the dead, and he's preaching anything but forgiveness. And the right-wing religion industry are having an hissy. Bill Donahue, whose freaky followers at the Catholic League were so outraged by a sculpture of a chocolate Jesus with his Jesus parts under the loincloth in, you know, real living shape and form. They were so incensed about it, the sculptor had to flee for his life a few years back. You know, practitioners of the religion of peace, they are. The Catholic League, headed by that pasty-faced, doughy old freak Bill Donahue, said it was quite a weekend for the haters. Speaking of Pope Benedict XVI, Bill Maher said Benedict told them he was going to resign because the church needs a fresh young face somewhere other than a priest's lap. Saturday Night Live, I think that's pretty funny. Saturday Night Live usually hits above the belt, but the segment it did on Jesus and the Apostles on February 16th was vicious. The skit, The Jesus Uncrossed, was a takeoff of Django Unchained, the extraordinarily violent film that has been the source of much controversy. The SNL segment was itself uncharacteristically bloody. There was also a snide remark by the announcer saying the skit was less violent than The Passion of the Christ, which it was. This under the heading, Maher and SNL Get Dirty. Really? Poking fun at hypocrisy is now dirty. Dirty. But that's okay. That's all right. We will. We'll have to give the Catholic League a pass, because after all, they had backup today. You know that there was argument in the Supreme Court today over whether or not we should continue allowing black folks and persons of color and various and sundry economic undesirables to continue voting in this country. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act being the point in the thing under question. It is time, frankly, if we had a functioning government, and we do not have a functioning government. Our government is wholly dysfunctional. It is time to impeach and be done with Thomas More asshat wearing Antonin Scalia. He's said a lot of outrageous things over the years, but today he crossed the line. He referred to the Voting Rights Act as, and this is a quote of Fat Tony, a perpetuation of racial entitlement. Now, beyond the fact that at first blush that phrase appears to be word salad, what he's saying is that continuing to compel a handful of states to get pre-approval for any changes to their voting laws. He says that, which is Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, he says that that's a perpetuation of racial entitlement, that making states who have a history, almost their entire existence, a history of abusing voting rights, making them sort of stay under the watchful eye of the federal government, that somehow makes... What the hell does racial entitlement mean? And I don't ask that because I don't understand the meaning of the word racial or the word entitlement. I ask that question largely because while I'm fairly well versed in right-wing and racist and Klan code, I'm really having a hard time sorting that out. It is racial entitlement to be allowed to vote? Because that's where it ends up. If Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is racial entitlement, then what? Here's the transcript.
Well, it took me out of context.
These are all the words of Fat Tony Scalia, whose father was the head of the pro-Mussolini organization in the United States in the years leading up to the Second World War. That's a problem that I have, says Scalia. This court doesn't like to get involved in racial questions such as this one. It's something that can be left to Congress. The problem here, however, is suggested by the comment I made earlier that the initial enactment of this legislation in a time when the need for it was so much more abundantly clear was in the Senate there, it was double digits against it, and that was only a 5-year term. Then it's reenacted 5 years later, again for a 5-year term. Double digits against it in the Senate. Then it was reenacted for 7 years, single digits against it. Then enacted for 25 years, 8 Senate votes against it. And this last enactment, not a single vote in the Senate against it. And the House is pretty much the same. Now, I don't think that's attributable to the fact that it is so much clearer now that we need this. I think it is attributable, very likely attributable, to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement. And by phenomenon, I take it that Fat Tony Scalia means anything that he comes up with in his head. A phenomenon called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about. Oh, well, okay. Lots of things have been written about. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes. You following this? I don't think there is anything to be gained by any senator to vote against continuation of this act, and I am fairly confident it will be reenacted in perpetuity unless a court can say it does not comport with the Constitution. You have to show, when you are treating different states differently, that there's a good reason for it. Well, that showing's been made, Mr. Justice Asshat. I'm sorry, Tom Asshat. Lynchings were a good reason for it. Murder was a good reason for it. Simple disenfranchisement was a good reason for it. And all of those things remain a good reason for it. Because there is no evidence to suggest that given the opportunity, any of the states under the watchful eye of Section 5 would not try other means. Well, hell, they're doing it now. Look at the way the red states are gerrymandered. You couldn't get some right wing members of the House of Representatives out of their districts with a bumper jack. Scalia says, that's the concern that those of us who have some questions about this statute have. It's a concern that this is not the kind of a question you can leave to Congress. There are certain districts in the House that are black districts by law just about now. And even the Virginia senators, they have no interest in voting against this. The state, notice how he says, even the Virginia senators. That's because for all the attention that Alabama and Mississippi get and got, Virginia was the most entrenched, most racist place in the Union. just as a little historical side note, prior to his run for the presidency, earlier in his career, William Henry Seward, who would go on to be Lincoln's Secretary of State, took his family, and in the 19th century, to take one's family on a trip like this was quite the undertaking, took his family southward because he had friends in the South that he wanted to visit. And they were so sickened by the conditions in the Commonwealth of Virginia that Mr. Seward turned around, went home, and was tormented by his visions for the rest of his life. What he had seen in the way that white human beings treated dark-skinned human beings for no other reason than the color of their skin. In a fit of sickening sarcasm, Scalia said, "Even the name of it is wonderful. The Voting Rights Act. Who is going to vote against that in the future?" Oh, I think we can tick off a few names. Pretty sure Ted Cruz would. Rand Paul. He thought the Civil Rights Act was an unconstitutional overreach of government. He said so himself. But more to the point, Fat Tony Scalia is that constitutional originalist. And he hates legislating from the bench. And he doesn't like judicial activism. You know, he said it a million times. But now, all of a sudden, he's down for some judicial activism because he's afraid that the unanimous voice of the Congress, or near unanimous voice of the Congress, means that all them white people in the Senate and the House have been intimidated into voting for the Voting Rights Act reenactment because they don't have the courage to stand up against the Negras. I tell you what, when I start seeing Lindsey Graham's swinging from trees by night and led to said tree by torchlight parade and dragged to the parade out of their home and out of their beds in the middle of the night, when somebody grabs Jefferson Beauregard Sessions the Hood by his big old jug handle ears and drags him into the night, then I'll think maybe we've got a white folks getting intimidated problem. Until then, Fat Tony, shut the f*** up. Ray asking, wonder how many righties watch Lincoln hoping the 13th Amendment wouldn't pass. No, they didn't do that, Ray. Right-wingers and neo-Confederates watched it because they loved the happy ending. Jack in Shreveport writing in says, "What I thought was so egregious of Scalia's usage of the phrase racial entitlement is that he damned well knows how the word entitlement has been so manipulated by the right wing into a pejorative that its mere mention shows bias in the court, and that's the absolute truth. Racial entitlement, my word." Marty says, hence my posthumous Moran Monday nomination of William Berger and Ronald Reagan. Berger stepped down and created the vacancy that Reagan filled with Fat Tony Scalia and his Tom Ass hat, Moore hat. Under the subject line, The Gift, Bill in Helena says, "Fat Tony, the self-flagellating sadomasochist, is Ray Gun Ronnie's gift that keeps on giving. Just saying. Yep. So we've got a remaining half hour or so in the program if you want to jump in and get involved. There are a couple of stories out there that I thought noteworthy for a Wednesday. We have North Carolina Republican Walter Jones to thank for the concept of renaming French fries in the Capitol cafeteria Freedom Fries. He was a vocal supporter of the slaughter of the people of Iraq. But then he realized he'd been lied to. And since then, he hasn't been quite the vocal supporter he was before. Now, this conservative right-wing Christian has completely turned about face. He delivered an address at Young Americans for Liberty's conference. And it is, well, I have to say it's kind of refreshing to hear. I'm going to have to run up. It was rather a long address. Here we go.
Hold anyone to blame. Lyndon Johnson's probably right in hell right now because of the Vietnam War. He probably needs to be voted for Dick Cheney.
Audio wasn't the best in the world. What he said. Congress will not hold anyone to blame. Lyndon Johnson's probably rotting in hell right now because of the Vietnam War, and he probably needs to move over for Dick Cheney. I don't know. I'm sure Mr. Representative Jones has said a lot of things, but he's never said anything more profound than that. Of course, there's Dick Cheney out there running around with some decent human being's heart beating away in his chest. And that fact continues to utterly disgust me. Not just because Dick Cheney got a heart after he'd had God knows how many heart attacks, but because there is every reason to believe that he was boosted on the list. You know, the same way that Steve Jobs suddenly moved to Tennessee because he wanted the climate, and the next thing you know, he got some kid's liver in his belly. As F. Scott Fitzgerald once observed, the rich are very different from you and me. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the conversation.
Well, I guess Fitzgerald's a good man as any, to quote, isn't he?
I think so.
I remember one of his quotes saying, at the age of 18, our views are the mountaintops from which we speak. At the age of 81, they're the caves in which we hide.
True, true, true.
I have, I don't have a lot to say. I have I've just received a book. Just a minute so I can see. I'm afraid my eyes aren't as good as they used to be, Bob.
It happens, Jim.
Yeah, I know. This is entitled Hubris by Michael Isikoff.
Yes.
David Korn. And it is one of the most comprehensive reads that I have perused about the war in Iraq and its run-up.
It reads, if I understand correctly, and I've read a little bit about it, I haven't gotten my hands on it yet, Jim. It could very well serve as an indictment, could it not?
Oh, definitely could. I mean, good Lord in heaven, I don't think that the entire legal team that represented the Allies at Nuremberg could have done any better.
And that's definitely what needs to be convened. You know, a little get-together in The Hague with some gilt-edged invitations sent out to Dick Cheney, George Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, that
much. They would not be embossed in guilt.
Oh, we can do that for them. Maybe it would maybe it would fool them into showing up.
Not guilt. Not guilt. Mm-mm. I think maybe a summons or something like that. I mean, it's just incredible how that war was foisted upon this country. And, well, we've talked many times about that war. I was very impressed by your guest speaker tonight, or your guest caller.
Thank you, Jim. Mike is a brilliant and dedicated man, and he understands the stakes of the struggle without a doubt.
Well, I have been brought up, and I believe in my heart, and my father was instrumental in this, was the plight of the American Indian and his fight to preserve what was rightfully his. And there have been many groups in this nation that have been wronged. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to play politics.
No, it's not a competition, and I know you know that.
Right. And I just wish that man all the best, because he definitely has a very serious fight ahead of him.
But if anybody can prevail, he and his can.
Well, my hopes certainly go with him, I can tell you that. And as a footnote of this conversation, right above my head is a statue of an American Indian, and it's called the End of the Trail.
I know it well. I've seen its original out in Oklahoma City.
And that is, I know years ago when my father was designing the gates for our cemetery plot, he made an outline of that. And I couldn't think of anything more fitting, knowing him and knowing how he felt. And the only other one that I think appealed to him more was the Indian on horseback, appealed to the Great Spirit.
Yeah, those are both Frederick Remington, aren't they?
I'm not sure, but the statue is absolutely beautiful. It's sad. I don't like to look at it, really, but when I do...
James Earl Fraser is the sculptor.
Right. The statue is available on Amazon, but the appeal to the Great Spirit is just in graphic. And just to suffix this conversation, I've always, like I said before, when viewing how the American Indians were treated by all the white men, and we talked about this a long time over many, many episodes, many programs, it simply, in my heart, just wasn't right.
No. Words like short-sighted don't work. It was unsighted. It was visionless. Because they were operating in a mercantilist, the white folks when they got here were operating in a mercantilist system that said that they had to get everything, because if anybody else had anything, that diminished them.
Well, you know, here's the thing. When we look at some of the things that have happened in the 20th century, Adolf Hitler took a page from the playbook on the way we treated the American Indians.
Yes, he did.
And I've referenced a speech of his that was made on 23 April 1939 when Roosevelt had cabled Hitler and asked him if he was going to attack Poland. And, of course, he went through the whole litany of nations that he was not going to attack, but then he also tried, and really the whole Reichstag was laughing, and the whole world was laughing. It really put Roosevelt at a, well, kind of, I'm sure he was somewhat flummoxed, but he said, you know, you talk about us fighting. He said, how were your problems resolved? At the council table? And how did you subdue the Sioux Indian tribes? I'm simply following you, Mr. Roosevelt.
Yeah, many people forget, Jim, that at the same time the Civil War was going on, that Lincoln also had a war that he was waging against the tribes in the upper Midwest.
Oh, yeah, certainly did.
And it was a slaughter. It was vicious. It was brutal. And there wasn't any talk about freedom.
Well, look at our own Revolutionary War. I mean, you know, the deals that were made between the British Crown had asked the Indians, look, if we prevail, we will do the best for you. And, of course, they didn't win.
No. And in fact, it is one of the more sordid elements of the American Revolutionary history period. A lot of people don't understand that some of the original ill feelings toward Britain had nothing to do with the tea tax. They had to do with the fact that the British Crown had told the colonies that they could not go past the Allegheny frontier.
Right. Exactly.
And we did it anyway. And by we, I mean my forebears did it anyway.
Well, all that's in the history books, and it was under the banner of Manifest Destiny and all this other stuff. But, you know, a lot of people suffered to bring this nation into being. And I'm not trying to appear unpatriotic as far as my country is concerned. But I'm not without compassion. Feeling.
Absolutely.
And understanding of the mistakes that I think could have been avoided. But I don't know. When you look at the people hail Andrew Jackson, such a great guy, and on the $20 bill, I don't think you'll find an Indian in the Southwest who'll carry a $20 bill in his wallet.
Nor even Oklahoma. Nor North Carolina. No, Jackson's image has been severely diminished, and I've argued in the past, Jim, that, you know, the Democratic Party, of which I am nominally a member, annually has its fundraising dinner and calls it a Jefferson Jackson Day dinner.
I've heard that, yes.
Yeah, it's time to get Jackson off of that.
Well, you know, some...
That's like having a Hitler-Bismarck Day dinner.
Well, yeah, okay. Those are your words, not mine, but I understand what you're saying. But,
I mean, there are good things to be said for Jefferson, and there are good things to be said for Bismarck.
Oh, absolutely.
But the evils committed by the other two men are sufficient that they should probably be taken... It should not be included in any honoraria.
No, I think probably the only thing that Jackson ever did really was to, well, the election of 1828, that was a barn burner, but he did at least postpone the inevitable by threatening to tell his own vice president, J.C. Calhoun, you do this, you nullify me or my government, and I'll hang you as high as Haman.
And you know, there are so many, and it's a trap for people who love history to play the what if game. But you can argue maybe that things might have been slightly different if the secession trick had been tried in 1829 instead of 1860.
Yeah,
because you know, for instance, it was Calhoun after 1829. Who began making these speeches about how slavery was not only necessary but noble.
Well, I think it was Stephen Decatur Miller who said it's no longer a necessary evil, but a positive good, because I wrote a paper on him.
It was also Calhoun.
Well, I don't know who said it first.
Right, but it became, it got a lot of traffic.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, Decatur Miller was, my family's from a small town below Camden called Stateburg. And Stephen Decatur Miller was a parishioner of Church of the Holy Cross, and I've sent you pictures of that.
Yes.
And so it's an interesting role that people had to play, and psychohistory is something I don't get involved in too much unless I have some real, you know, a lot of papers and stuff like that and documents and things of that nature. And but nonetheless, I think after the nullification thing and after Stephen Decatur Miller left the governorship of South Carolina, because back then it was just two years, so he moved out west. And, of course, you know who his daughter was, Mary Boykin Chestnut.
Yes, yes, whose diary informs a lot of what we know about the home front in the South. Mm-hmm. During the war.
Absolutely. I can tell you, if you ever have a chance to get down there, you ought to, if you can get into Mulberry Plantation. And she was married to James Chestnut's son. It is an incredible place as far as history is concerned. Right there in that little enclave near Sumter, below Boykin, South Carolina, you find a lot of interesting things. Even a grave of Thomas Sumter. And I know I'm sort of going off point here, but Sumter had a beautiful plantation called Acton that the British burned. But in the graveyard there is a chapel built for Sumter's wife, who was a Catholic. And because Catholicism was not exactly practiced widely in that part of the country, he had a special chapel built for her, and it's still there. Now, everything has been stripped from the chapel, and they've had to, because people have taken everything from it, you know, except just the bare walls. But if you ever get down to that part of the country, I think you'd find it quite interesting.
Oh, I know I would. I know I would.
And anyway, that's about all I have to say. Other than the fact, like I say, when you saw those pictures I sent of Church of the Holy Cross, it's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Oh, it is indeed. And what's the name of that stone from which it's?
Oh, it's called Pied de Terre, rammed earth.
Yeah, rammed earth. Yes, pied de terre, and, not stone
and,
at all.
No, it's not. And as a matter of fact, a very good friend of my late mother's was on the renovation committee, and the church is no longer white, but it's the actual terracotta color. And, you know, I'll end this conversation on this note, even though the graveyard there is full. A lot of my ancestors sleep there today. Because that was their home.
Right, right.
The Borough House. And it's now on the National Register. And it's...
Oh, it's a beautiful structure.
Oh, yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, tell you the truth, Bob, let me tell you two things. It was made by Nathaniel Green, his headquarters. And you can still see in one of the columns of the house a bayonet carving in there.
Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. And referencing Andrew Jackson, after the Second Battle of Camden in 1781, or the First Battle of Camden, there were two. One was in 1780, June of 1780. One was in April of 1781. The first one, the British won. The second one, Lord Cornwallis got his ass kicked, along with Lord Rawdon. And I have seen the actual letters these guys wrote when I did research at the archives there in Columbia from the Continental Congress papers and the British Public Records Office, their descriptions of battles and things like that. But going back to Jackson, he was imprisoned as a boy by the British at the jail in Camden, South Carolina.
Fascinating. Just got a note in from Bill out in Helena, Jim. He said, let's screw the Native Americans again. Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people were forced by the U.S. government to live on arid and barren land, and now it turns out that it just so happens that that arid and barren land sits on the Bakken Shale. Lawsuits galore. The lawsuits allege that a land grab by the petrochemical industry has cheated Dakota tribes out of $1 billion.
I'm not surprised. Not at all. But, you know, the petrochemical industry, let's face it, it's very powerful. It goes into more than oil. It goes into fertilizers, chemicals, and all those kinds of stuff. And as you said, billionaires can squash you like a bug, and they definitely have established a very firm foothold that's going to be very, very difficult to erase.
But we know that they are not stopped unless they are opposed.
Well, I guess so, you know.
And so, you know, I have tremendous respect for those with the courage to do it.
Well, I do too. And like I say, I enjoyed your telephone guest tonight, and I certainly hope that he will be able to find some way to preserve what is left of his homeland and its natural resources.
Well, what's left is beautiful indeed, Jim. And I know you've spent time in Wisconsin. I don't know if you've ever been that far north, but my gracious sakes, it's beautiful.
Now, I understand that. Okay, well, listen, you take care.
I will. Thank you, Jim. You do as well.
Out here.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim. And that kind of wraps the evening up. We made it to... I got a notification that Sal had followed up on the challenge. And so tonight we are finishing up at about $60 away from where we need to be on any given night, which puts us, about $230 to finish February. That's tonight and tonight's over, and then tomorrow night. Thanks for all you do to keep all of this going. Never think for a minute that we don't know that every penny represents a sacrifice on your part. If the program was a little disjointed tonight, I apologize. But, you know, I've said before that, you know, we used to do a lot of guests in the past. I don't do a lot anymore, because so many of them are so transactional in nature. But I want to thank again Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins Jr. for joining us this evening for that conversation. That conversation was not transactional in nature. It was earnest. It was heartfelt. It was, in the plainest sense of the word, true. So, if you want more people to know about what's going on in northern Wisconsin and about the abuses that are taking place, the podcast will go up in short order at whiterosesociety.org. Spread that link around. Just tell them, don't tell them to listen to the whole show. Just tell them to listen to the first hour. Because this is probably one of the most underreported stories of an environmental and human rights nature in the country today. There are a lot of things that compete for our attentions. This story is worthy of that attention. And if we want to be the media, we can. And we can share that information. And, of course, there's never any charge for downloading a podcast from White Rose. So thanks, everybody. Back tomorrow night to finish up the month of February. I hope you'll join us. Thanks to all of you, as I said, for keeping all of this going. Thanks for your calls, your emails, your ideas. Thanks for your kind contributions. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Sparky, I should add, is also the moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype chat group on Friday nights and sometimes Saturday nights. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to Agnes for help with the show posts. Thanks to John Fox in Australia for all he does to keep me from just running out into the night over various and sundry technical gremlins. Thanks to Ben Birch, who single-handedly saved progressive radio on the Internet when he created the White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org. And thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acheact.org, A-C-H-E-A-C-T.org. And always, always, always. Gina, Judy, it's all for you. And now it's time for Rick Smith on the Horn.